This is an oral interview with CUCM Julian P. Goodmanson, who has extensive field experience with the Navy in both the Arctic and the Antarctic. It is part of an oral history program of the American Polar Society and the Byrd Archival Program on a grant from the National Science Foundation. Okay, we're rolling.
Good. I was born on a farm in Minnesota, southwestern Minnesota, back in the Depression days. I was born on August 1st, 1916, and I went to a country school after I got old enough to go to school. There's a country school. I had all the eighth grades in one building and had one teacher. After I graduated from the grade school, I went on to high school, and I graduated from high school in 1934, and you couldn't get any jobs back during the Depression days, so I always had a notion I'd like to join the Navy, so I had to go about 100 miles to the nearest recruiting station, take the test, and I passed everything except the colorblind test. I'm colorblind, I couldn't pass the test, and you had to be perfect in those days because they had more men volunteering than they could take. So I had to go back to the farm, and I worked around the farm for years, and then I worked with a construction company. And in 1937, I met a woman by the name of Dorothy Bunning, and we fell in love, and we eloped to Watertown, South Dakota, and were married on April 16, 1938, and I continued my construction work. I worked on the building of the army camps across the country, and finally we got to California, and all the camps had been built, so I got a job at the carpenter shop at Douglas Aircraft in Los Angeles. And one night, we were listening to the radio. This was in 1943. And they put out a call for construction workers. They were forming a new branch of the Navy. It's called the Navy Seabees. And they were the construction battalion. And they got the CB from the Sea of Construction and B of the Battalion. And I was sent to Virginia. I was accepted and I was sent to Williamsburg, Virginia to Camp Perry for CB training. And we had our boot training done. Then we were sent to Gulfport, Mississippi. And after our training at Gulfport, we went aboard an LST and we headed for the Pacific. And they never told us where we were going. We went through the southern route to Bora Bora, Pago Pago, New Caledonia, New Hebrides. We finally landed on Guadalcanal. And I spent my whole time on Guadalcanal. I was there when the war ended. And on the day they signed the armistice on the ship in the harbor up in Tokyo, we went aboard the old Navy ship and headed back for San Francisco. And after we got to San Francisco, I went home and for leave. And after leave, I got discharged from the Navy. And I went back into construction. And in 1951, I got a call asking me if I'd like to go back into the Navy because they needed CBs for the construction again. So I went and enlisted again, and I was sent to Norfolk and joined the CB battalion there, MCB6, and we went to Argentia and Bermuda and Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and then got back from Cuba. I was assigned to Naval Beach Group School in Little Creek, Virginia to be an instructor. And when I was at the school, they put out a call for Operation Deep Freezes. And I went in and put my request in for join Operation Deep Freeze, and went to take my physical examination, and they had the submarine physical. You had to pass, and you had to be perfect for there, and there was that color that had, I flunked that again, and I thought, that's an awful thing to stop. I didn't think it would bother me on construction. So there was a captain there, I don't recall his name. I went to him several times and asked him if he couldn't forget about the color blindness. And finally, one day I went in there and I said, Captain, there's two colors down on the ice. The snow is white and the buildings are international orange, and I can tell the difference. And he banged the table with his fist and he said, I guess the only way I'll get rid of you is let you go. So he wrote, qualified. So that's the way I got my start on the Antarctic trips. I went up to Davisville, Rhode Island.
I've got a question. Did you go to the Arctic first?
Yeah, after I went up to Rhode Island, I joined the Deep Freeze 2, and they sent a group of us to the Arctic. We went up to Thule and joined the engineers, and they had a camp on the edge of the ice cap there. And we went out on the ice cap and practiced blasting crevasses open and closing them with bulldozers. And then we went out and had a Wanigans. We went out a trip. We were supposed to go out about 200 miles on the ice. And these Wanigans were like a trailer house on a sled. And we'd go pulling them, and we'd go so far, and we'd stop for different times. And we were instructed every time you stopped, back up so you'd have slack in your hitch, because there'd be enough heat generated from the sled runners running over the ice that they'd freeze whenever you'd stop. So we would back up like they said, and when we would start out again, it'd break all the runners free and we could continue. After we finished the training, we went back to Davisville, Rhode Island, and joined a Deep Freeze 2 unit, and then we headed for Antarctica. We flew from Davisville, Rhode Island, and with stops at San Francisco and Hawaii, and then one of the islands, and finally into Christchurch. And in Christchurch, New Zealand, we went aboard the icebreaker, Glacier, and we went into the ice aboard the Glacier. And
was that Glacier's first trip to the ice?
No, I think it had been there
second year.
Yeah. So we broke through the ice, and we had several cargo ships. Last ship in line was a tanker, and the ice would form around the tanker and freeze them in there once in a while, and the icebreaker would have back and circle around this tanker and break it loose, and then we'd go on in. And we finally got to McMurdo Sound, and we unloaded there. Part of the battalion stayed there, and I went with a group to Little America. We took a cargo ship from Little America. I can't remember the name of it, but we unloaded at Little America, and then there was a group there that built part of the camp the year before, and our group finished the construction there and took on more cargo, and time was short, so we unloaded everything on the ice, and then the ship left, and we had the rows marked with the red flags, because we know they'd be covered with snow, and we had these flags, we could find them when we went back out looking for the cargo. And we spent the whole winter hauling cargo. We'd go out there with a bulldozer and have to dig the snow away from the boxes and haul it back to camp. And part of our detachment went over to Bird, and they hauled much of the material over on a sled to Bird, and they constructed that, and then they come back and we all headed back to Rhode Island. And can you stop in a minute?
Okay, here we go.
When I was first joined the Operation Deep Freeze, I was a chief builder. The rating was BUC for chief builder. Then I went up one rate. It is E8. And then I went up to E9, and that is BUCM. And then they changed it around and made it
CUCM.
CUCM, and it's kind of backwards on explaining what CUCM. It means Master Chief Construction Men. And that was the final rate that I kept all the rest of the time I was in the Navy. After we got back to Rhode Island, I was assigned to recruiting station in St. Paul, Minnesota. And I was there 25 months, and I got a call from the detailer, and he said, asked me, he said, "Are you in good health? Any broken bones or anything?" I said, "No, I'm in good health." And he says, "Great, their blaster is sick, and it can't do the blasting for the nuclear power plant, so you're the only qualified one that's available. So today I'm going to send you a set of orders for Antarctica again." So I went down to Antarctica for Deep Freeze 61. Then it came back again for, did all the blasting for the nuclear power plant. There were several pits that had to be blasted into the mountain side where the reactor was put. And we also blasted enough for another reactor for it to be built later on, because they couldn't blast near a reactor that was there. So we dug four pits for the reactor. And then the next year I went back, and with Mobile Construction Battalion 1, and we did the construction of the nuclear power plant at McMurdo Sound, and also put up some tanks.
Let me back you up a little bit to Little America. Tell me something about life at Little America when you wintered over. What was it like? Were you down underground? Under the surface of the snow?
Yes, we were under the surface of the snow at the Little America. It's always blowing snow across the land there, the ice there in Antarctica. And the minute you put an obstacle, it starts covering it up. And we were completely covered, and our smokestacks, we would have to extend them farther and farther up through the snow. And they had the ionosphere camera on the two-story height, so that never did get covered. But we had to shove the snow off some of these buildings to keep them from collapsing. And at the pole station itself, that was getting collapsed so bad, we had to go in there and remake some of those buildings and put in extra reinforcement for the round them to support the roofs. And we built an electric generator there. And it was a terrible job there in cold, because it was so cold there at the pole.
This was which year at the pole?
At the pole, let's see. That was in 1963. Deep Freeze 63, that's...
Back to Little America. Did you meet Dick Chappell there?
Yes, I met him there, and I helped him to work on the ham station there, because I was a licensed hammer operator, and Dick wanted to be able to operate the ham station, so I helped him all I could. And we had a Russian scientist there too, by the name of Rostorgiev, and he used to like to talk to his friends over in Mirny. So I sent many messages across from Little America to Mirny Station and this Rostorgiev. When he got back to Russia, he would contact me several times, and I operated a radio station in St. Paul, and he contacted me there once, wanted to know if I'd forward the message down to Antarctica to his friends there. So I kept in contact with this Russian scientist for several years.
What was his specialty?
I don't remember what it was now. I don't remember.
How was the food in the winter and year round?
It was tremendous. It was the best food we ever had. In fact, the Navy sent their cooks to a special school before we went down there to teach them how to make as good of meals as they could. And another thing, any time we worked on 2 12-hour shifts there, and any time you were hungry and wanted something to eat, you could go in and make yourself a steak or anything else. And we ate twice the amount that normally a person would eat, because the cold weather would make you need that, because it sap your energy and stuff.
What was the coldest temperature?
The coldest temperature was at Little America was around 80 below. And I took one crew into the pole, and it was 50 below zero when we got in there. This is in the summer, just the beginning of the summer. And the warmest day that I was at the pole was 14 degrees below zero.
At Little America, did you get down into any of the former camps from Little America 1 through 4?
No, never did. No, never got to any others.
Could you see any of the antennas and stuff sticking up?
No.
From the other ones?
No.
So they were all snowed over by then.
Yeah.
How did you unload the ships there?
Well, I was in a blaster there, and the ice shelf was very irregular. And my job before the ship came in was to go out and make a straight ice shelf so they come right up to the ice shelf, and they could hoist with their booms all equipment up on the ice shelf. And the way I did that was with shape charges, they call shape charges. The shape charges sent the beam right straight down, the blast right straight down, and lots of times you can use that, put a shape charge on the metal and blow a hole in this metal. But I put them in a whole row down along this irregular ice shelf, and sent them all off, and it just made us broke off a straight ice shelf, just like you take an ice pick, you know, when you take ice and break an ice. This is just like using many ice picks, and all of a sudden, and it just broke off that shelf just as nice and straight as could be.
Nice smooth pier.
Right.
Did you put bollards in it?
No.
How did you tie the ship up?
Well, I guess we did say we put a like a railroad tie down into the snow. You could call it a makeshift bollard. Yeah, that's the way we did hang up.
And then you use ship cranes to offload?
Yeah, ship cranes unloaded everything onto the sleds, and then we took the sleds over just about a quarter mile away and unloaded them right on the ice there, because the ship had to get out in a hurry because the storms came so bad there and so fast that we knew that we wouldn't be able to have time to unload everything, because Little America was about a mile and a half in and we didn't have enough sleds to haul it all that far as fast as they were unloaded. So we just unloaded it right by the ships there and then spent most of the winter coming out and digging it out and taking it back to camp.
Did you have any of the ice front break off unexpectedly?
Yes, and I pretty much went to sea with it too, because I was right across, we were in a little bay, and they wanted the point taken off so they'd have a little more room to turn around. And in Dick Chappell's book, it shows me running and that ice shelf breaking off, and the man on the icebreaker was there, was calling over the PA system, loud as could, run, run, to me, the ice is breaking. And a whole chunk broke off, and I was just fortunate, able to jump over this place where it hinged and broke off there. And like I said, it's in this book that Dick Chappell wrote where I was running.
You have to do with the scientists. Did you support any of them or work with any of them?
We would stand there, some of their watches, like on the ionosphere and stuff, you know, and they couldn't be there 24 hours a day. We'd set the cameras when the ionosphere would really, the Aurora Australis would come on. We'd help them on that. And I, being a typist and a ham radio operator, I sat in. We were radio or weather central for all the stations, and so all the stations would send their weather in by numbers. So I'd go and help, and I'd sit there for by hour, just plugging in with the typewriter, hitting number, 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 which meant nothing to me, but the weather people. That was their code.
How did the men in general interface with the scientists? Did they get along good as a team? Scientists come from a very esoteric world, and these sailors come from a very practical world.
No, we got along well there, and we were... Back in Rhode Island, we were going over very thoroughly. They sent four psychiatrists up to go over us. And they only missed one man at our place. Everyone got along swell except this one man. And this woman was interviewing me one day, and she's asked me a lot of questions. It seemed silly to me, but it made sense to her, I guess. And we were in a small room together, and the doors opened, and she asked me, she says, "You know, if I went over close to that door, would you try to rape me?" I says, "Well, we can find out if you go over and close that door." She kind of looked at me and continued, and I guess that was a good enough answer for her because I was accepted.
So you had one person that the psychiatrist missed.
Yeah.
Authorizing.
I didn't get along with anyone.
Dick Chappell. Dick was a young Boy Scout that was selected to come down. How did he fit in?
He fit in, well, he was a very pleasant young man, and he was always willing to help. When he asked me to help him on the radio, he was just really conscientious to learn to do that ham radio, and you heard him on this over here, and he got to operate it, did a fine job on that. And another thing, when Admiral Byrd died, you know, he was supposed to come down with us too. We met him, we trained under him back in Rhode Island.
So you met Admiral Byrd?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And my crew built the Admiral Byrd Memorial Chapel there, and Chappell said, I had a biggest beard there, so he had me sit up in the choir seats, and I couldn't figure out why he wanted me to go there. So I went there, and well, what he wanted to do, he put my picture in his book because I had the biggest beard down in Little America.
So they had a chapel for Admiral Byrd at Little America.
Yeah, a memorial chapel for him, right.
Yes. And when, tell me about your experience with Admiral Byrd. Did you get to talk to him extensively?
Well, it was back in Rhode Island that we got to talk to him, because he gave us instructions and bought the ice and what we should do and what we shouldn't do and everything else. And he gave a kind of lecture from the stage, and then afterwards he mingled with the crowd, just any questions anyone had, he'd wander around with the group that was in there listening to him.
Mm-hmm. Did you get to talk to him in a personal sense?
One-on-one? Oh, yes.
What was that experience like?
Well, that was really a thrill, because ever since I was young, I was admired Admiral Byrd, or read all about the stories of him winning over there by himself in the isolation and all that, and I thought that was tremendous, a man to do something like that.
And then you went it over and heightened the camaraderie.
Yeah, right.
I volunteered to went over for some reason.
Tell me about what happened. You were down in Antarctica when he died.
Correct?
Yes.
How did that hit the camp?
Well, everyone felt very bad about it, you know. Like they lost a friend, because he was so friendly to us back in the States there. And like I mentioned, he'd talk to all of us, and he gave us all the instructions, and he just like one of us, you know. We felt he was one of us, the way he treated us there.
Had a special service for him there?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a chaplain winter with you?
Yes.
Was it Catholic, Protestant?
We had a Protestant, his name was Zoller. He wintered with us, and the Catholic chaplain was over at McMurdo.
Then you built the chapel after you built a chapel in the name of Admiral Byrd. You already had a chapel. After he died.
Yes.
Okay. And that was done Cumshaw, I assume.
Yeah.
Yes. Were you the leading chief?
Yes.
So you managed the building of the first Byrd Chapel.
Right.
Okay. Well, good.
One day I was on the radio, and I got a call, was put out, and the Air Force was making their initial flight to the Boeing jet tanker, and they were flying over the North Pole, and General Griswold was aboard, and he was on the ham radio there, and of course they asked for a call, and of course everybody that was calling there wanted to talk to him, so I thought I didn't have much of a chance from being cleared out in Antarctica, so I put in a call. I said, call this call sign, I forget it what it is now, and I said, this is KC4USA from Little America, and he came back and he said, is this KC4USA that put in a call? And I said, yes it was. He says, well, we'd like to talk to you, this is a historic moment, pole to pole. And then he said to all the other callers, he says, please stand by. After we finish with Little America, I'll take you one by one up there. But then he, Griswold from the National Geographic was aboard too. So he came on radio, and General Griswold said, we're taping this. And I said to myself, you big dummy, you got the tape recorder and you didn't push the button right away. So I pushed the button right away. So I got it right here in one of these tapes now, that the pole-to-pole call talking to the initial run of the Boeing jet tanker with General Griswold aboard and Gilbert Grosvenor of National Geographic. And they had some other operators there too, which came and talked to, I don't know their names, said, this is Joe and this is so-and-so. Some of the workers on the plane, I guess, they let them talk to us too.
What was your personal call sign?
K0OEE.
K0OEE. Mm-hmm. Where did the Golf Oscar uniform Delta Yankee come from?
Yeah, you asked me that the other day. I didn't get the...
That's what Paul Dalrymple passed to me.
I don't know. I didn't... Well, I suppose I'd say that sometime when they couldn't get the name, you know, like part of this message I was talking to my son back there before chapel came on. This ionosphere was really rough there, tearing us up, and sometime you would give your name like that. So that's what he was maybe referring to.
Yes. That's what he was referring to when he told me to ask you that.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on. You went home after you went it over right away or at the end of the summer? You came down one summer, you wintered, and you're there part of the next summer, or after sunrise.
No, I went home and I got orders to Naval Recruiting Station in St. Paul, Minnesota. Then.
Okay. And you were there how long?
I was there 25 months till, well, I mentioned that earlier, but I got the orders. They called and said, are you anything wrong with you, broken bones or anything like that? And they jerked me off recruiting. I still had 2 years to go. And they didn't have any experienced blaster for Antarctica.
And you were senior chief then? Or?
No, I was chief then.
Chief then. You were chief the first time you went and went it over.
Right.
Leading chief at Little America.
Yeah.
Okay. For the start of IGY, right?
Yeah.
Okay. That's a milestone.
You know, getting back to that blasting and stuff, when I got down there, they had sent a bunch of TNT from the magazine in Pearl Harbor. I don't know how long that had been in there. And it was leaking out of the box of the damn TNT. And it was so dangerous, I was afraid somebody would get killed with it. So I took all that behind the mountain there at McMurdo, and I blew the thing up and sent for new stuff called Pelotol. And Pelotol is just like, what's that grain you eat?
Grano?
It's little pellets like
yes.
that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And when you drill a hole in the ice there, and you got the volcanic ash, there'll be a layer of volcanic ash, and then there'll be some snow, and then some more volcanic ash. And the drill bit will make heat there on the volcanic ash, and the snow will kind of melt there, and it'll be irregular hole you have, so you couldn't put dynamite or anything pushed down there. This pelotol, you could pour it down and it'd just take the shape of any hole was there, and then you'd take a dynamite at the top of the whole thing with the charge in it and set that off. That'd send the pelotol off, and you'd have to blast the whole hole that way.
Mm-hmm. And you had to blast a deep pit under what was to be the nuclear reactor?
Yeah, it was in the hillside.
Yes, and Observation Hill.
Yeah, an Observation Hill. So up on the top was about 30 feet, and it came out to nothing there in the hillside. And
so basically making a step
to
put a building on.
Yeah. And the reactor went into there, and then they poured rock, crushed rock. We had a rock crusher down there, and we crushed rock right a little ways from where the nuclear power plant was. We hauled that in, and we poured that around. First, there was around the reactor, there was a kind of a shield, and they poured like BBs around it, then to keep out the radiation. Then they poured crushed rock around the thing to fill that hole And then the sad thing about it, the reactor sprung a leak into that rock, and it was very little radiation, not really enough to hurt anyone, but the order, you know, that you cannot contaminate anything in Antarctica, so they had to shut the nuclear power plant down, and they had to take all this rock and ship it back to the States and put it into one of these sites where they have radioactive materials. Okay. When they were blasting, and evidently over the years that island was built with that volcanic ash and then snow, and then it's more volcanic ash would come and then snow. And it is very irregular, your blast sometimes. And I made one blast, and a big chunk of the lava went up one of those snow channels, and it is headed right straight for camp, McMurdo, on the base there. Well, the crews had been into one of the shops there where they had their machinery there, and for lunch break, and they just left. There's only a couple of guys left in there, and this rock came arching over and went through the roof, hit one of the pieces of machinery, bounced off the floor, and hit one guy in the knee, and not too hard, it didn't hurt him. And it could have killed some people if they'd been in there yet. So they had an investigation to see if I'd done something wrong up there, and they had several days checking everything out, and I was cleared. They said it just wasn't my fault, it's just a freak of been one chute there in the snow that this one rock blew instead of going this way, it went backwards.
Working in permafrost.
Right.
Did you winter over when you came back to McMurdo that year?
No, I just wintered over at one time.
Only one time?
Yeah.
Okay, so you had how many more seasons on the ice when you came? You had Little America, then you came back to McMurdo, and how many seasons did you have after that?
Six.
Total seven with Little America.
Right.
Okay, so you came back as the chief blaster for a nuclear plant, and how many seasons? Two together there?
Yeah, I went down with MTB1 the following season to build it.
So you built the nuclear power plant?
Right.
The building, or did you move in the reactors too?
Everything.
You were in charge of construction?
No, I was the operations chief, and I was in charge of some of the operations there, but I was the leading chief there too.
You were the leading chief at that time, in McMurdo?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Off the MCB-8.
Of MCB-8,
yeah.
Okay. Which year, which deep freezes were those?
Well, let's see. They were deep freezing 61 and 62. And then 63, I went to the pole.
Deep freeze 61, deep freeze 62, McMurdo.
Mm-hmm. Now, 61 was doing the blasting, and 62 was the construction.
Okay, tell me about the construction. How did the nuclear power plant, it's quite a historic event as having a nuclear power plant, we'll never have another one there. How was it specially constructed? Is that different than the other buildings at McMurdo?
Well, you had to have the support for the generator, so you had to have a pit and a framework that the generators would be sitting on, and everything was engineered, so they had the openings where they figured it should be, and they had the panels, everything all set up for interior offices and everything were all prefabricated stuff, and that was And then when the generators come in, they were all slid into place and went over this place of the support for the generators.
Any Army with you?
I don't recall any on that operation.
I asked the question because it's an Army reactor type plant for a field reactor.
Yeah, no, we went out to Wyoming, a crew, before we went down to build the plant, and they were building a smaller plant there, and we practiced out there before we went down on the construction of that.
When you went down in deep freeze 61, did you go down by ship or did you fly in?
Flew in.
Did you fly in from then on?
Yes.
Did you go out by ship at all?
The year that I blasted, I went out by ship because that was the last transportation out. So I went on a New Zealand ship into Christchurch.
Which ship was that?
It was a tanker. I can't think of the name of it then.
Fuel tanker?
Mm-hmm.
Did it tank us? Did it tank McMurdo?
It evidently did, yeah.
Yes, okay. You don't know the name of that tanker?
No, I don't.
Okay. It wasn't the Mommy?
No, I can't.
Okay. Tell me about the life in McMurdo as compared to Poe. What did, I mean, as to compared to Little America. What was life like in Deep Freeze 61 and 2?
Well, it was one of the main differences that you had melting at McMurdo, and the vehicles running around in this melted permafrost there, so it'd be running down the streets and stuff. It was quite messy at times there in McMurdo.
Mm-hmm. Good food?
Good food, right.
Little America, how many men were at Little America?
I think there were about 50 of us there.
And at McMurdo, how many were at McMurdo?
Oh.
Aviators, everyone.
There'd be hundreds there. I don't know overall how it'd be, but there's quite a large group of men there.
Okay. And did they all get along together? Were there rival factions? Or just good camaraderie between the aviators and Seabees and the ship drivers and scientists?
Everything went along pretty well, except there was a Air Force had some officers with us on one of the operations. I forget which one it was, and had the young officer, and he didn't have any common sense there. And the captain of the base, I can't recall his name now, this is kid me about this guy. And then this officer went out to Mount Erebus there, and there was a kind of crevasse there, and he went and crawling in that crevasse and that little shelf, and he got so far in there and he got scared and he couldn't go ahead and he couldn't back up. So I had to get the camp people to go out there and rescue him. And the captain in charge of the camp, I can't recall his name, and he used to talk to me quite a bit, you know, because I was leading chief then too. And he asked me, he says, "Can't you get take care of that damn idiot you got?" I'll never forget that.
You're put in charge of Air Force officer.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. They didn't teach them leadership, did they? Okay. When you relieved the Winter Rovers, did you come in on first flight and relieve the Winter Rovers, or did you come in later?
At the station, you?
Yes.
I Usually we did, yes.
Mm-hmm. Did they put them on, they get them out of town right after the summer season started, or did they keep them over through the summer?
Well, they get rid of them pretty soon, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Any problems that you know of during the winters? Like you talked about the one fellow that had problems at Little America.
Not that I know of, not being down there over the winters up on this side, like McMurdo and stuff. I haven't heard any reports on anything like that.
Okay. Deep Freeze 63, you were at the South Pole, correct?
Right. I was with MCB8, and the pole has been crushed, and a lot of the buildings were not safe to be in. So we went and got a lot of snow off some of the buildings that are being crushed, and we put in heavy timbers in the walkways and across the top of the buildings to strong beams to support in case we had more snow later on. And we at Bird, they had these snow blowers, and they could dig a beautiful trench, and then they put arches over that, and then didn't have to worry about getting crushed. So, but we couldn't get a big snow blower into the pole. There's old small tractor, so we dug a trench just with a bulldozer, and then we took arches and put over this trench that we dug with the tractor and put building under these arches so they wouldn't get crushed like those old wooden ones that were out there before. And it was pretty doggone cold, and we built a new generator building there too. They needed, their generator was worn out and everything, so they put in a whole new building and everything, bigger one, the new generator, so we installed that. And
so this was, you rebuilt the whole station?
Right.
So this was the first rebuilding of South Pole.
Right, right, yeah. And at the pole, we had a football game there with a scientist. That was the first pole football game, I guess. And we had a big guy we called Moose Marino. And he's about a 200-pounder. Boy, he plowed through those scientists. And we beat him 6-0.
Uh-huh. In bunny boots? Were you in
bunny
boots?
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of slouched down.
Yeah. I didn't play. I was 46 years old at the time. There's no place for a 46-year-old to be at the 10,000 feet in cold weather, 50 below. The AP, the Associated Press, even wrote that thing up about that football game. And when I was at the pole, Lowell Thomas came there, and I run a ham radio contact back to the States. I don't know to whom anymore, but it was really a thrill to sit back, and after I got them connected to the States, to listen to that voice I'd heard over the TV and radio for years. So.
Sitting right next to you.
Yeah.
Okay. Was he, Admiral Reed, you brought him there?
I think so, yeah. I'm not sure.
So you were there when they flew the flights from South Africa across Pole to McMurdo? Was it that year?
I don't recall that. I don't.
The reason I asked is that Lowell Thomas was on that flight.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. So do you remember what kind of planes were they flying to Pole then?
They were flying these 121s.
121?
The skis. Is that, with the cargo plane, wasn't that 121?
The C-130s, you mean? Or the...
130. The ones that the cargo plane that they used all over.
Four engines, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
C-130.
130, yeah.
Right. You remember what kind of science were they doing at South Pole at the time?
I don't know about that.
Any astronomy?
Oh, yes, mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, when the way they came into the polo, the C-130s, they would not stop when they bring in cargo. And they, as they entered the runway, they'd raise the nose up and they'd open the back door, and they had these rollers and the cargo on there, and cut it loose and let the stuff go bing, bing, bing out. And when they got to the end of the runway, they had the, all the cargo out, and then we'd have to go and drag it off there. And they flew in with the helicopters too. And the first helicopters ever to go into Poland, they hauled them back in the C-130s.
You see, were these Army helicopters?
Yes.
Did you recall the name of the Martin Pomerantz as a scientist that was there?
No, I don't. No. We even had some drops there at the pole, too, by the Air Force, you know, with the streamers. And it was bad weather, and so that's one reason they sent them in, because it couldn't fog in, there's snow, whiteouts and stuff. So it's an eerie feeling to hear those plop, plop, plopping when they were coming there. You know, I wonder if they're going to miss and hit the station with one of those drops, you know, but everything went well. And
what'd they drop? You mean they streamed them? They didn't parachute them?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Any parachute drops?
No, not, they're pretty all streamers. Mm-hmm. They did, I think, early in the operations, there's a Caterpillar, they parachuted. They had one of the small ones, and the thing didn't open, and it hit the snow, and I think it went down about 30 feet. And what they had done was, at the end of the season, you know, put all the mail in there. All the guys were looking forward for the mail, so there was some heavy digging out there. Caterpillar out there so they could get their mail.
So they got the cat out.
Yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah.
So, how many seasons did it take you to rebuild the first rebuilding of the South Pole?
Just that one season.
Just that one season. Yeah. And do you know how long that pole, that station held up before they replaced it?
No, I don't recall. I guess they replaced it with that dome.
72.
And I don't recall the year they did that.
That was 72. They opened it anyway, 72. Yeah. And it's being replaced now.
Yeah.
With a whole new complex on stilts. Now, that takes us through Deep Freeze 63. You came back three more seasons.
Yeah, I went in Deep Freeze 68 and 69 with the same outfits from Davisville. It was a Construction Battalion Unit 201, and that was just regular construction there. Upkeep for the camp, and we built some of the more fuel tanks and things like that. So we had 2 years of work for our group there. So we went in 68 and 69.
You were leading chief?
Yeah.
For 201?
Right.
That was CBU 201?
Yes.
And
I was a master chief at that time, so I...
And you finished building 155? The big chow hall?
Yeah.
And barracks?
Yeah.
So you were in charge of opening up 155, I guess, moving everyone in there?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What other facilities did you build there in McMurdo?
Some warehouses and the more tanks. Those fuel tanks, it seemed like we never had enough fuel tanks.
Mm-hmm. You mean the big ones up on the hill?
Yeah.
That surrounded the camp.
You know, were you down there when that tanker was crushed and finally had a big storm and the tanker went out to sea and disappeared?
The AG?
Yeah.
No, I wasn't. I know about it. Were you there?
Yeah.
That was, when what was that, deep freeze 61 or 62?
I can't remember which one it was now, but the thing went out to sea and nobody ever saw it again.
Do you know, that was the YOG, I believe.
Yeah, I think so.
So it was blown to sea in a storm. And where was it anchored prior to that?
Right by Hut Point.
In the Winter Quarters Bay or on the other side?
On the Winter Quarters Bay.
And that was during a storm in, what, April, March?
Yeah, I think it must have been around April.
Was it full of oil?
No, it is about crushed. It has been a derelict there for years, just crushed.
So it had been sitting there, and they didn't know what to do with it, and eventually the ice pushed it up against the shore and crushed it. Okay, but then it blew out to sea. It must have sunk in the storm.
Evidently.
Probably further up McMurdo Sound.
Most likely, yeah.
Most likely didn't get out of the sound.
Yeah.
Did you see it happen?
No.
It's an interesting event. Do you know who, I assume it was after everyone left and it was the Winter Over Group saw it go?
Could be, yes.
Do you know who was any of the Winter Overs then?
No, I don't. Well,
that's interesting. No fuel spill.
No.
Okay, that's deep freeze 68 and 69. Tell me about life in the camp in the summer. Did you have any personnel problems, drinking problems? Was there too much drinking? Was there too little to do for the men? Did they need recreation?
No, I never knew really any problems. The only problem we had was Little America when I went her over. We had one young kid there that pretty well loaded a good share of the time there, but at McMurdo and stuff, just a normal drinking, the guys would go to the bar in the evening and stuff, but no one would really go and get plastered or obnoxious or anything like that, because when you had a 12-hour shift, they were usually...
Okay, after 19 deep freeze 69, you went back to the ice again, and what unit were you attached to and what was your job?
I went down with Com Nav Sup for Antarctica, and I was the master chief for that unit, and I could never quite understand why they selected me for master chief for this. Antarctica is more of an Airedale outfit than the CEC, but I guess they needed the master chief of command, so I went down in 69, and that was the first time I ever went down with women. They had women aboard that outfit. And
that was the first year they had women down there? Or?
Well, with that I ever was with.
And which year was that?
That was in 75.
Okay. And they had women military?
Women military.
CBs?
No, they were just regular Navy.
Admin, personnel.
Yeah, right. And that's the first time I really run into a problem with the personnel there. There's one woman, she was malingering and stuff, and she kept saying I can't go out today and everything else, and I kept track of her, and she had the excuse that she was having her period. I kept track of this, and the fourth time, I called her in because they complained about her was malingering. And I said, you know, I think I'm going to turn you into, what's this thing about the wonders of the world? What's the program?
Yeah.
Because you're the first person I've ever seen that could have four periods in 1 month. And she admitted that she was trying to escape, not having to go outside and stuff.
How many women were there down there at that time?
Oh, I don't know. There were several women. I can't recall the exact number of them right now.
Were there women scientists?
Oh, yes, yeah.
Mm-hmm. They were older? Older than the women sailors?
Oh, yes, yeah.
You remember any of the women scientists?
No.
Mary Alice McWinnie?
No, I never had any contact with them.
The first two were nuns.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
No,
they were scientists, yeah. But they were nuns. Yeah. First two to winter.
Yeah.
Or sisters. Did you have any problems with the men? Vis-a-vis women, any competition, any fights, any nice stories? Did you have any marriages out of all that?
No, the only problem I had was with this one woman. Otherwise, everyone seemed to get along well. And when we got back to Port Hueneme, I retired from the Navy, and I had one of the first color retirements. All the photos, movie and stills, were all in color, and it is on the grinder there in Port Hueneme, and I couldn't believe what a fantastic send-off that was for me. And that's, I think it was about 8 master chiefs for side boys for me, and went off and furnished a car for my wife and mine. And my son flew in from Minnesota, he was there too. And that was really an appreciation. I really appreciated all having a retirement like that. And this Captain Howe that I'd worked with the 3 different times, he was up in San Francisco at the time. And I requested him to be the speaker there, so they flew him in for the speaker, main speaker for the retirement.
So you retired from the Naval Support Force Antarctica when you retired from the Navy.
Yes.
Well, that was a wonderful career. Who was your relief as Command Master Chief? And what year was that you retired, by the way?
In 76.
It wasn't Paul Drexheimer, was it?
No.
You knew Paul?
No, I didn't know him either. It was in September 76 that I retired from Commonwealth Support.
Well, you had a good career, 30, how many years?
30 years.
30 years on the nose. And you spent a tremendous amount of time in the polar regions, amongst other things.
Do you have any high points that you recall that really made it special?
The high point, I think, of my career was to be selected for the White House staff. I think that's one of the top assignments for a military person, is being on the White House staff. And I was up with Cap David most of the time. I'd go down to the White House sometimes. We'd take a crew down there and do a little fixing or something like that. And for all the people you met there and being invited for dinner down to White House, wife and I and stuff like that, you just can't believe that things like that are happening to you.
You met the president?
Oh, yes.
Who was the president then?
Lyndon B. Johnson.
Okay.
And he used to bring a pastor up with him to Camp David, and we'd have church services there. And after the services, Lady Bird would come out, and just like your little country church, she'd stand out and talk. All the dependents were invited up to the church service when they had services. And she would stand out there and talk with all the wives afterwards, and just like this small country town, and just couldn't get over that. And all the women folks were just thrilled to death, you know, that they could have a chance to talk to Lady Bird Johnson.
So you went from the chapel at Camp David down to Antarctica to the Chapel of the Snows later on for services.
Oh, yeah. We lived right down below. Camp David is right on the hilltop.
Yes.
And right below, they had a house in a circle there, and all the people that are working up in Camp David lived on the housing just at the bottom of the hill there. And it was so interesting, too, all the people that had come up there, and ambassadors and the cabinet members, and then they'd have people, you know, the European hierarchy come there. It's always going on, and we had several vehicles there, and because a lot of the guests of the president would like to see the countryside. So we'd have to have drivers to drive them around. And we had several of the stewards up there that we had to use sometimes for driving. And they, our cars were all stick shifts, and they didn't know how to drive them. So we had to go and train them, take them out on the road and train them to handle a stick shift car. And one thing, on most military commands, you know, you'll have the number of the car on the side like that. Well, so we didn't attract attention. All our cars had Pennsylvania license plate on them, and under the hood was the number of the car, so when we take it into the garage, they'd raise the hood for repairs as if they had the number of the car, but there was nothing showed exterior. You see the car drive up and down the streets around there, you thought it was just a regular car.
Yeah. So, and any regrets about your Navy career? Any disappointments?
No, not really. I, like I mentioned earlier, I was in high school. I wanted the Navy. I don't know why I had an urge for the Navy. Never had an urge for the Army, Marines, or anything else. I always wanted to get in the Navy. And when I finally got into them, I was really happy and satisfied.
Yes. I asked you about Admiral Byrd. I forgot to ask you about Admiral Dufay. You meet Admiral Dufay?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What'd you think of him?
I thought he was a nice person. And let's see, I think it was Admiral Tyree, too, that came up before he left when I was blasting for the nuclear power plant. And he congratulated the whole crew because we were just within hours of finishing this project. And he congratulated us for good work on the job. And that thrilled all of us that Admiral would come up there and do that to us.
Tyree was a good man.
Yes.
Then you went to South Pole the next year, and that was when Admiral Tyree had left and Reedy took over. Did you meet Admiral Reedy?
No, I don't think I ever did meet him.
Mm-hmm. Then how did you go out? You flew out in C-130s, or you flew out in when you flew back to Christchurch?
No, we usually flew.
That wasn't clear in my mind.
Usually these, what was it, 124?
The 124s?
Yeah.
The Air Force, the big Air Force planes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Double deckers, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, they still were using them. Flying off the blue ice runway?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Did you have anything to do with the blue ice runway or any of the runway construction?
No.
You never did?
No.
Okay. Well.
Okay, did you know Larry Gould?
Yes. He was president of the College of Minnesota, I think it was Carleton College, and maybe in the Minnesota mind, I'd like to talk to him about Minnesota. So we'd sit down to the fat sometimes about Minnesota when we'd meet.
When was he down there? When was that?
I can't recall right now. There's so many times I was down there, I just can't recall which one.
Oh, he came down a number of times.
Yeah.
During IGY, did he come?
Yes.
Yes. He was president of IGY.
Right, yeah.
Well, tell me about his personality.
Oh, he enjoyed it. I thought he had a wonderful personality.
Flamboyant?
Yes.
Good leader?
I would say he was, yeah.
Good scientist?
Yeah.
Set a good standard.
Right.
He was a bird man. Bird's chief scientist. Mm-hmm. That's what these guys called themselves. Many have said that the Birdman, the Goulds and the others who were with Bird, Paul Seipel, mm-hmm. You met Paul Seipel.
Oh, yes.
You did. How did you interface with Paul?
Well, before we went down, we just barely saw him, but when I was in charge of the recruiting station in St. Paul, Minnesota, he came to Minnesota to give a speech, so I went over to where he gave the speech, and I had bought his book, so I took the book along, and he autographed it. I have my book over there now on the table there that he autographed for me.
Mm-hmm. You see him in Antarctica?
No.
You didn't meet him in Antarctica. Did you meet Eddie Goodale?
Yes. Oh, yes. I think I rode down one time with him.
He was working for the staff.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Another bird man.
Mm-hmm.
They say that our programs today were an outgrowth of the bird expeditions.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I agree with that.
You could feel their presence.
Yes.
Yes. Trying to think, Dr. Jim Zumberg, did you meet him?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
He used to be a piano player.
He was a piano player?
Yeah.
Are you a piano player?
No.
No? Uh-huh. And he played the piano in where, the clubs?
Yeah.
At Little America?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did you have anything to do with the Traverse where they bought the cats from Little America over to McMurdo?
No.
They had a Traverse that brought them along.
No.
Oh. When did Dick Chappell leave? Did he leave after the... you wintered over with Dick Chappell,
right.
Correct? And you all left after the winter, or did he stay on for the summer?
I think he left about the same time we did.
I see, and went off to college.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think that pretty well does it. You've had a wonderful career and met some interesting people. And I'm sure that you set a standard for the young men that work for you, too.
Well, thank you.
And it certainly shows. and I appreciate you contributing to this. So with that, we'll
just terminate this.
Having a man like Captain Howe select me 3 times. So it makes you think that you are pleasing someone. If they want you at 3 different places, you must be doing a satisfactory job.
More than satisfactory.
I started out once